Shut up, mate.
The CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, BPI Stats, Daily Motion, and Kate Bush. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me, as it always is, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello. That was all you asked for me to say. You didn't encourage me to expand on hello, so I said hello. Happy Easter.
Yes, this happy Easter.
This is the Easter special. There's a very high chance that by the time you hear this, Easter will have happened. But it is the Easter special, so there's going to be lots of chocolate in this episode, lots of bunnies in this episode, yeah. and maybe a little bit of Jesus, because apparently he also has something to do with Easter. That will be running throughout. It'll be very subtle. You may not even spot it. It's going to be so subtle.
Well, they're all in here. It's just that in audio form, you can't see.
No, unless...
But all that stuff's in here. Jesus in the corner.
Well, I mean, he might say something
at some point. Really. I mean, it's not a special.
And then you would be able to hear him, whereas I don't think the chocolate... Bunnies don't really make a noise, do they? There's a bit of noise as they jump up and down, but they don't sort of meow or bark like cats and dogs.
No.
So therefore, the bunnies probably will remain silent.
Well observed.
Throughout. So, yeah, welcome to the Easter edition. I hope you enjoy it.
Talking of Easter, or indeed not at all talking of Easter.
Except that this is a story that begins in a supermarket where there would be Easter eggs.
Yeah, though
so
now...
There's
now,
a definite segue here.
Now you've spoiled the myth that this is all off the cuff and we don't discuss things beforehand.
Well, I would have to approve what you're going to talk about.
Once again, you're destroying the myth or the mystery. What was it I said lifting the curtain last week?
You did. So Andy Malt was in Tesco's the other day. Was it Tesco's?
Don't name them. But they don't sponsor us.
But it was Tesco.
I've got to try and get sponsorship off them now so not, we can put this out.
Not Sainsbury's or Waitrose.
And I was looking for a...
An Easter egg?
No, I was looking for a magazine in the magazine rack.
A magazine?
Because that's a thing I still do sometimes.
You buy print magazines?
Occasionally.
You're such a maverick. And not only do you...
I buy vinyl, I read magazines. What of it?
Yeah, but you go to Tesco for your magazines. I get you're probably one of the people that goes to Tesco's for their vinyl as well, don't you?
No.
You say, oh, I'm a vinyl, no. I'm a vinyl customer, but I buy it all in Tesco.
Bringing us round to what I was talking about.
So you went into the Tesco magazine aisle.
You know those serialised magazines where like, they sell the first one, here's a magazine, get a free binder, subscribe, and then 700 issues later you've got some magazines in a binder.
There is a term for that kind of magazine, part edition magazines or collector edition magazines.
That sounds more likely.
In the olden days, this might still be the case because I don't watch any live TV anymore, so therefore I don't tend to see much advertising. I very occasionally go to the Channel 4 On Demand app, yep. Whatever that's called these days. It's not called 4OD anymore.
All four.
And those moments, I do actually experience TV advertising. But most of the time, I'm not on there. I don't watch live TV. So I don't see much TV advertising. But it used to be that those would always be TV advertised.
Yeah.
So let's say it was, I don't know, music through the ages. It doesn't have to be music.
The classic was I Love Horses.
I Love Horses.
I Love Horses, best of all the animals.
Was those the ones
everyone remembers that
that came with a little model of the horse?
I don't remember what was in there. I just remember the jingle.
Or sometimes they're like...
I love horses. They're my friends. Great jingle.
Or they might be like, there's knitting ones, aren't there? And everyone's got a pattern or uses a different kind of wool. And they would advertise it for the...
You know a lot about knitting, don't you?
For the first edition would be advertised on TV. And then the first edition would always be like 20p. And then the second edition would be 50p with a free binder. And who wouldn't want a free binder? And then once they'd hooked you in, they were about £27 per edition. And there was about 1,000 of them that you then were committed to buy so that you, in essence, had the book that all of these magazines made up.
Correct.
This is the format.
Now you've brought the kids up to speed.
Well, are these still quite common? Because there used to be hundreds of these damn things.
I don't normally go into Tesco and look at these things. However, what caught my eye was the current one that's being hawked. Is the Beatles vinyl collection.
And this is new, so people could start collecting now.
It's not in shops now before they take it out of shops and print the rest of them for the five people who actually subscribe.
Well, that's the business model of those collector things is, yeah, they print lots for the first few, and then once they've hooked people in, they only print as many. So if only 37 people sign up, it doesn't matter because from issue three onwards, they will only print and indeed press in this case, 37 copies. So it's the Beatles vinyl. So basically, is it every Beatles album on vinyl?
Every Beatles album on vinyl, yeah. 180 gram, you know, good quality vinyl.
How many Beatles albums were there? That's not going to be as long...
704.
That's not going to be as long a collector series...
No.
...as the average one of these.
No, but vinyl's quite expensive.
Well, it is, I understand.
And this
that.
Vinyl gets more, like we say, it gets more expensive as you go on. After issue three, quite expensive.
Yeah, it'll be £100 per edition.
It depends on how many discs there are.
So, and will it include the greatest hits albums? There's almost an Alan Partridge joke in here somewhere.
I did not look closely enough, but I would guess.
And then there was the number ones album, wasn't there?
I don't think they're doing all the compilations.
And then there was a soundtrack to the Cirque du Soleil show. So it's just,
I don't think they're doing that one.
Well, once they've hooked people in, they and they're paying
just keep it rolling,
£50 per edition, they might as well keep it going. So, yeah, so this was Tesco selling not only old-fashioned print magazines, but also old-fashioned...
cover mount vinyl.
...print vinyl. Yeah. Well, definitely vinyl. Is there a cheaper bargain basement flexi-disc version?
Oh, I would buy that one.
I'm not sure they ever did 12-inch flexi-disc, did they? That might be pushing that technology.
No.
I mean...
the 7-inch was
didn't
pushing
really
that
work.
Technology. But I don't know what that says about the vinyl revival, but probably something.
It probably says something about the vinyl revival. I remember flexi-discs, which, again, for young people...
Well, basically, it was a crisp packet turned into a record that didn't really play.
Well, people, where was I recently? Everyone was telling me that the cassette revival is definitely back on.
I bought a flexi disc not that long ago.
So perhaps the flexi disc revival is coming soon. So usually they came on the front. I used to get them on the front of Luckin magazine.
Yes.
Back in the day. But I remember, I think it was, there was a serial that did a series of flexi discs. It was probably Shreddies or Weetabix, I don't know. And if you bought them, it came with one. But they were glued to the back of the box. And I don't know who thought of that, because there was no way of getting it off the box so that the flexis would still be flat and playing. And I seem to remember on the second one, I had to actually cut it out of the cardboard and then put the cardboard onto the... turntable with the
flexi-disc.
Well, in some ways it might have helped, I don't know. But the Beatles Flexi-Disc Collector Edition, there must be a publisher out there who could make that happen. And you'll have at least two subscribers, and that's probably double what you're getting on your Collector Edition vinyl
thing. I don't know.
Thing.
If you don't have all the Beatles albums on vinyl, that's not a bad deal. I mean, I probably wouldn't want to buy them all in one go, you know, one a week.
I do know one person who works in the industry who is a real Beatles completist. Because you remember when they brought out, was it that they brought out the mono version?
Yeah.
Of all the albums. Was that it? That was that way round.
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh, God, I'm going to have to rebuy because he's completist. He was like, I'm going to have to buy all of these. So I'll have to make sure that he's aware of this. And the Lennon and McCartney estate will get even more money.
The magazine, and actually you get lots of free gifts as well.
Free gifts?
You get two storage boxes.
Wow.
And a frame to put one of the albums of your choice in.
Recognising that people are not going to listen to these
various
records.
Other things.
And presumably a magazine about each of the records.
Yeah.
So all the background information.
Well worth it.
Well, depending on the price point. If it really is £100 an edition,
it's
then
not £100 an edition.
Worth it at all.
I think at its most expensive, it's £47 an edition.
Well, there's anyone who hasn't yet bought their
Although
Easter
Although I think
gifts.
You do get two records with the £47.
Is that because they're putting... each album across two records, or is it two albums per edition? If it's two albums per edition, there can't be that many editions.
Well, I haven't looked that closely into it. I'm not actually going to sign up for it.
You came here with this story and you've not researched it for our listeners who might be looking for
it. A bit. I looked at the website. The website was not actually very forthcoming with information. That said, you just reminded me. There is a TV advert for it, which
is
you
there?
Can play on the website. So if you Google it, you can watch the TV advert for it. I could play it now if you want it.
No. I think we've talked about this way too long.
Yeah, I'm not sure we have time. Anyway, that's it for this week.
If there are any listeners who forgot to buy an aging vinyl fan relation, an Easter present, you want to do something special, then perhaps rather than going for the predictable chocolate, then maybe a little bit of the Beatles vinyl collector magazine from Tesco.
Yeah, buy them issue one because that one's only $9.99.
Yeah,
then you can saddle them with the cost of the rest of them.
Let them pay for all of the others. There's a plan. This is not what we're here to talk about today.
Well, funnily enough. It kind of is.
You're going to say we're going to talk about the vinyl revival.
We're going to talk about some stats that include vinyl revival stats.
We are.
We're also going to talk about Daily Motion's attempt to get itself off music industry enemy number two position.
Which has nothing to do with vinyl, the Beatles, or collector's editions. No. And then finally we're going to talk about
Kate Bush and how she's not playing a festival.
Nothing to do with
so this is a very short section, because everyone knows that.
So your attempt to segue the intro to the podcast failed, but anyway, let's move on and let's talk about these bloody BPI stats.
Sure, why not?
That were unleashed this week, this morning, as we record the
podcast. So we recently learned when the RIAA put out its annual stats that the American record industry's revenues grew double digits, 11%. In the UK, not double digits, 5.1%.
But it is still...
still good.
It's still good growth. So these are the figures for 2016.
Still enough to buy some sparkling wine. not champagne. Not yet.
So you might be thinking, didn't the UK record industry put out a load of figures for 2016 right at the start of the year? And yes, they did.
Yeah.
But the figures that come out around about sort of New Year time, the BPI put out their consumption figures, where they talk about how much music has been consumed. So in the olden days, that would have been units. So rather than money, it was how many albums were sold, how many singles were sold. But obviously in the streaming age, they now have that slightly made-up metric so that they can put streaming data.
Yeah, and they're basically completely meaningless stats.
So the music consumption stats come out at the start of the year. Then the Entertainment Retailers Association put out the retail value of music in the UK. So that's
slightly
basically
more meaningful.
How much money went through the till of high street retail and of mail order, which is mainly Amazon, and that also includes the money that went through the download platforms and the streaming platforms. So that's how much money comes in through retail, although A, that includes the retailer's cut, so some of that money isn't actually coming to the labels and the artists, it's staying with the platforms or the shops. And also, of course, it only includes the money generated by, I mean, it is CDs, downloads and streams, but it doesn't include any of the other revenue streams. So sort of sync income and the money that comes in from radio and the money that comes in from public performance and all of that sort of stuff. Whereas these figures are basically how much money came in to UK record companies in 2016, and as you say, it is 5%. In fact, I think it's 5.1%. I think you might have been...
I said that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, all right then. 5.1% higher in 2016 than 2015.
That's how we know, because I said it.
Is it? Is that how I knew that?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I know that because I wrote the story in the CME Daily this morning. And you've then just pulled all the figures out of my excellent story.
I didn't even look at your story. I went back to the press release.
Well, I did ignore
Don't trust your story.
I did ignore the vinyl revival. So you wouldn't have got the vinyl stats if you'd been relying on me, because I'm bored of the vinyl revival. But it was the highest revenues in 5 years for the UK record industry. So that sort of fits in with this story that from 2000 to 2010, 2011, the record industry kept going down, down, down. So every year, the record industry, whether in the UK or worldwide, was making less money than the previous year, even though iTunes had that, you know, explosion in sort of, when was that, 2007, 2008?
Yep.
But CD sales were continuing to plummet, so it never managed to compensate for the loss in physical sales. And then it all bottomed out around about 2012, 2013, and now we are back into a period of growth. And before we get on to the bloody vinyl revival, that growth is in the main being fueled by streaming.
Correct. Premium streaming, not so much ad-funded streaming, because that doesn't bring in very much money. The overall 61% increase in streaming in 2016 that offset the slight fall in physical revenues and the massive fall in download revenues.
Yeah, the continuing plummeting of iTunes income, which, is getting smaller and smaller year on year. So that, there was that figure, wasn't there? There was that 1 week last year, which we've brought up on several times on the podcast, when vinyl sales in terms of revenue, not units, outperformed downloads in the UK last year. And people keep quoting that stat back to me, but it was that week in sort of December when everyone was starting to buy Christmas presents, so physical sales were having that slight uplift. It was the week the Kate Bush box set came out, so that was generating huge amounts of money for relatively low units.
Yes.
And so there was that week where actually vinyl revenue outperformed download revenue. That isn't happening across the board, no. Although there were some stats in the press release talking up how vinyl, although it's not outperforming downloads, it is sort of, you know, bringing in, say, half as much money as the equivalent, I think, of albums, digital album sales, or something like that. So it's not outperforming downloads, but it is decent percentages of value.
Yes. So as you say, there was a 61% increase in streaming overall, largely premium streaming. Physical still the largest single revenue stream, but there was a 1.9% drop in physical revenues. CDs driving that, coming down by 9.1%, but vinyl saving the day by bringing its revenues up by 66.5%.
Which means that it is now 15% of physical.
5% of total.
5% of total.
So, yeah, there's your vinyl revival. It's now 5%
of the wider
all revenues.
Recorded music market. Although, you know, because I turn all of these into little bar charts. We're waiting for the global figures to come out later this month. But I turn them into sort of little bar charts for my presentations that we do with the CME Insights courses. And that little vinyl box, it is, I mean, I think it was 3% a couple of years ago. Now it's 5%.
It is growing.
So,
yeah.
And also, it's not only is it growing its sort of share of the overall market, obviously, the overall market is growing as well. So it is quite impressive, although not as impressive as every single broadsheet newspaper suggests every time they write about the vinyl.
Someone recently brought up to me by a broadsheet reading person. I won't name that, isn't it? It's all vinyl now, isn't it? It's only vinyl. And they said, but it's not new vinyl. They're not making new vinyl anymore. And I was like, well, you think the entire music industry is propped up by secondhand vinyl sales? You think we're doing that badly?
So not only were they under the impression that the record industry was basically being bankrolled by vinyl sales, they thought it was resale of old vinyl.
Yeah.
Rather than newly pressed vinyl.
Yeah.
So yes, overall, physical is outperforming streaming. I mean, if you combine streaming and downloads together, then digital is now a lot more significant than physical on its own, both CD and vinyl. But if you take streaming on its own, physical is still slightly outperforming streaming. Although we always have to remind people that these aren't quite like-for-like figures.
No.
Because what happens is, just because of the way that the publishers are paid, so obviously whenever recorded music is sold or streamed, the record companies are paid the lion's share of the money, but there is royalties also due to whoever controls the song copyrights. So that will be a publisher, and also obviously a big chunk of that money goes to the songwriter. And because with digital, the services pay the publishers and the songwriters, sometimes directly, sometimes through the collective licensing system. Whereas with physical, the money comes into the record company and then it passes money on to the publisher and the songwriter. The publisher's share are included when the record industry declares physical sales. So immediately the money that's coming in for CDs and vinyl, I think it's about 8% of that, would immediately be handed over to the publishers, whereas there is no publishing to pay on the digital income. So I would suspect, if we put that in, I haven't done the maths, I haven't got my calculator with me, but I would imagine if you did that, it probably would mean that streaming and physical were pretty damn close in terms of the revenue they were delivering to the record industry once the publishers have been paid.
I mean, in all of this, I think the real success story, other than performance royalties being up 1.8% and sync being up 0.6, sync being the other thing that everyone thinks is propping up the industry.
And it's even smaller than vinyl.
Ringtones up 9%, bringing in an extra $500,000.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you're being sarcastic here, but it really brought in $500,000, an extra $500,000.
An extra, yeah, like over $6 million.
$6 million to the record industry?
Yeah.
Wow. Who's buying the ringtones?
Well, I mean, a lot of that's me.
Is there some collector's edition magazine that comes with a free ringtone every week that's sort of boosting that up?
I don't know. But I mean, that was too positive. I think we should throw some scorn on all of this now.
Okay, throw in some scorn.
Well, we've got two bits.
Two bits.
Normally
of scorn.
We only have one bit.
Well, let's do the bit that we always talk about.
The caveat to all of this is every time there's a positive record industry story, and like the BPI or the RIAA or the IFPI, whoever, come out with, they're like, "Woo, we had some growth, we made loads of money." But if it weren't for YouTube, we would all be living on individual islands by now.
We said streaming is up dramatically. It is driving the growth. However, it is paid for streaming that's bringing in that money. So actually, if you split the streaming income up between that coming from subscriptions from like Spotify and Apple Music, etc., that coming from the free audio streaming, so Spotify free, Deezer free, which is actually the smallest slice of the streaming pie, but then less than 10% is coming from, well, what they call video platforms. So that will predominantly be YouTube. Although YouTube income comes in through different sources, doesn't it? Because some of it comes directly from YouTube, some of it will come via Vevo. Warner sells its own advertising on its official channels, so the advertising money will be coming in through an ad agency. But all of that combined is a relatively small part of the streaming income stream.
Yeah.
Too many streams going on there. And so, yes, obviously, safe harbour, value gap, all of that. I mean, actually, whereas the RIAA, when they put out their stats a couple of weeks ago, published a big long blog post, most of which was about safe harbours and the value gap and the fact that YouTube should be paying more money and that although all this growth is great, we should have way more growth if it wasn't for bloody YouTube. The BPI statement that came out with their stats pack today, it had a little bit about that, but actually it was focusing on the potential challenges of bloody Brexit, which is the second potential downside.
Yeah, Brexit, that's quite a big thing. As anyone who has actually looked at the figures and data and anything involving trade, which I know is very few people, Brexit's going to fuck everything.
Basically, in their statement, BPI CEO Jeff Taylor, well, obviously he was in lobbying mode because that's one of the BPI's big roles for the industry, and was basically saying that, hey, Theresa May and your silly mates in the Brexit crew, when you start sitting down, both with the European Union, but also post-Brexit, when you start doing your trade deals with all the other countries, please remember the priorities of the creative industries, of which the music industry is part of that, of course, and that you don't end up allowing barriers in place that make it impossible for all but the superstar British artists to go out and tour and to promote their music abroad, and that you know, any money coming in from international sales doesn't just get wiped away paying duties and stuff like that. So a little bit of Brexit lobbying in the press release,
but,
in addition to the YouTube is evil.
But given that every single industry that trades internationally, and particularly with Europe at the moment, is saying exactly the same thing, we'll have to wait and see if those pleas are heard. But for the time being, sparkling wine all round.
5% up.
5%.
Well done, everybody.
Still to come, bit of news in brief, bit of Kate Bush. But now, Daily Motion. And we said that, you know, the video platform stats, largely YouTube. But you don't want to forget Daily Motion.
People usually do.
People usually do. but Daily Motion is there. And it is full of all the sorts of illegally uploaded user-generated content / just TV shows and other people's stuff.
Yeah, user-stolen content, as I like to call it, on there.
But it's going to try to move away from that.
It is indeed.
Not least because it has a parent company in common with Universal Music now.
Yes, so Daily Motion, YouTube rival, big in France. So like Deezer, it's still a big player in the French market. Doesn't have so much profile over here in the UK, although I don't know as much about how Daily Motion's rights management systems work, but I do know, and I think the main reason why people might find themselves on Daily Motion from the UK, ironically from a Google search, taking them to a site which is a competitor to Google's YouTube, is that I think there are whole loads of TV shows which are very much taken down on YouTube, and as people upload them, they get taken down quite quickly, whereas they sit there on Daily Motion and don't get removed. So I think one of the reasons why UK people might end up on Daily Motion is that there is stolen content that has been taken down on YouTube, which is still sitting there on Daily Motion. But as you say, it is sort of ironic that as the record industry and the wider music industry has become more vocal in recent years about the bloody safe harbours and the value gap and the fact that there are these websites that anyone can upload content to, but then those sites sort of repurpose all that content and present it as if they are a TV network, and the record companies feel that these people shouldn't have the safe harbour protection and they're exploiting a loophole in copyright law. And when the IFPI or whoever actually get round to listing the websites they're talking about, the safe harbour dwellers, as I like to call them. Obviously, YouTube is always top, but Daily Motion is often in that list. They do often say YouTube, Daily Motion. They used to say SoundCloud. They've now got deals with SoundCloud, haven't they? Facebook would probably go in there next now.
Yep.
But Daily Motion is quite often in that list, which, as you say, is ironic because since 2015, the vast majority of Daily Motion has been owned by the French company Vivendi, who also own Universal Music Group and are also in the TV business because in France they own Canal Plus and the film side of the Canal company. So here you have a company who desperately doesn't want people to be sharing their music and their movies without license. They don't want people exploiting loopholes in copyright law that stops their music company and their TV and movie company from getting as much money as they can, and yet here they are now owning a platform that is exploiting that loophole and enabling people to share all this content without license. So that has seemed like a bit of an ironic anomaly for a while now. So it was not that surprising when the announcement came out this week that Daily Motion is having a big fat revamp in June, and although the option for users to upload content isn't being removed entirely, it's very much not going to be the priority for Daily Motion. And I think ultimately they're going to move away from that completely and try to become, which may or may not work, in essence, a sort of an on-demand TV platform with only licensed content.
Yeah, it's almost like they're aiming to become sort of an ad-funded Netflix sort of thing. They're going to prioritise professionally produced videos and then share the ad income with the people who've made that content.
So it'll be a combination of sort of newsy content and sort of short-form TV-style content and music content. And I think what's interesting is it looks like that Dailymotion now will be more proactively working with the Canal Plus side of the business. In fact, the CEO of Vivendi's TV company Canal Plus is now the CEO of Dailymotion. Also, there'll be a lot more tie-ups with Universal Music, certainly in France. But they don't just want to keep it in the house. They are looking to go and do deals with other content providers. And I suppose the sell they're offering, well, part of their sell is we get all these millions and millions of people coming to our site and we can put your content in front of them. But it's like, yeah, but the reason why you've got those millions and millions of people coming to your site is because of all of that user-stolen content that you don't do a very good job of removing. So if they do get better at removing that content, or they sort of shove it to the back of the platform where it's really hard to find, then will they still have the millions and millions of people? But the other thing they are saying, although they're being a little bit vague about this, but they're saying to content partners, by which I think they really mean music companies, TV companies, film companies, although maybe sort of YouTuber type talent as well, come to us and we will do two things. First of all, we're going to change the way we present the content. So we're going to be a little bit more like the Facebook video idea, that when you come there as a user, it will sort of format content that is A, relevant to you, and B, timely.
Yes.
And they're going to play on the daily in their name.
Yes, some daily curation.
Yes, so here's your Dailymotion. And then the other thing that they're saying to content creators is we're going to offer better terms than YouTube.
The Tidal route.
Yeah, 1% more than everybody else. So we don't really know what that means, but the standard YouTube deal with content creators is that the creator gets 55% of ad income. So we don't know whether that means they're offering 56% of ad income, or whether they're talking about offering content providers significantly more. I suspect it will only be rev share. Obviously, what content creators really want is some sort of minimum guarantee. Certainly, that's what music companies want. Maybe minimum guarantees are going to be part of the deal. I don't know. But I think they would have been saying that if that was part of the deal, and they were just a little bit vague and said, but it will be better than the competition, by which they surely mean YouTube.
Yeah, so we'll see that all unveiled in June and find out more, I guess.
And it'll be interesting to see what the music side is. Apparently, will be a music tab, I think, in the all-new app and website, which they're saying they've built from scratch. So it's not just a sort of a revamp of the existing platform. In essence, it's a whole new platform pulling in content off their server. So it'll be interesting to see what the music bit is like. Presumably Universal Music are going to embrace it.
Well, you'd think so.
Although sometimes that's a sort
of... It would be fun if they didn't.
Well, that might be the parent company saying to Universal in France, you have to embrace it, but they'll embrace it in a sort of half-assed way and it won't come to anything. But maybe they will embrace it. And in doing so, try and, I don't know, well, if Dailymotion could start to pull people away from YouTube and Universal have more control over that, because in essence, they are part of the company that owns it, perhaps that would increase their negotiating power of YouTube down the line. Who knows? What about Vivo? It's always the other question, which obviously Universal Music also has a stake in. It's all very complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see what happens and whether or not they can get themselves removed off the IFPI's We Hate These Safe Harbour Dwellers list.
Time for a bit of news in brief now. And first off, the biggest news of the week, Harry Styles is going to release his solo album at last.
So yes, we have both the date and the name. I think that's what's new. I mean, yes, we surely knew an album was coming because we'd had the single, hadn't we?
Well, we knew an album was coming, but I think we've been talking about an album coming for about 16 years.
He's been off being an actor though, hasn't he?
He was an actor for a bit.
He's
yeah.
been off doing some acting, but he is now back as a pop star.
Yeah.
That one single came out last New Music Friday.
Yeah.
Was it last week that it came out, or was it the week before? I can't remember. Recently, a new single came out. So we now know that on the 12th of May, the debut Harry Styles album will come out. And it's going to be called...
Harry Styles.
Harry Styles. So yes. Really gone above and beyond titling his album. The press release calls it a self-titled debut.
Not words we will be using in CME.
They mean eponymous. I don't understand why some parts of the music industry don't like the word eponymous. Is it that they think
it's a bit wanky?
Is that what it is? It sounds a bit pretentious.
But all albums are self-titled.
Well, exactly. Well,
unless you're forced by someone else.
Well, exactly. Most artists choose the titles of their albums, so they are self-titled. I mean, I suppose some pop acts, probably the label chooses the name, and then they're label-titled. But most albums are self-titled, so stop using that. When what you mean...
Harry Styles' parents chose his name. I think they should get credit.
Well, they named him, not the record. It was him that decided to call the record.
They named the record by proxy.
Is that what it is? Okay, well, what's the sort of the pretentious, wanky word that means that? Parentimonious. Would that work?
Sure, why not?
So Harry Styles' Parentinominous album will be surely by definition an eponymous album. You could say that about every eponymous album. Because the eponymous album is, it's the person's name. I suppose if it's a group, that's not true. But
yeah.
if it's a solo artist, then by definition, an eponymous album will ultimately be a name that was selected by their parents.
Titled by proxy.
Titled by proxy. Is that what you're going with?
Yes, that's what we use.
Proxyonymous. Yes, Harry Styles' Proxyonymous album will be out on the 12th of May. Is the first bit of extra news that we need to slot in this week.
Troy Carter! He's going to advise the Prince Estate on sorting everything the hell out.
Yes, hopefully he has noted that Harry Styles' Sign of the Times, which was the name of that track we mentioned, isn't a cover of Prince.
Sheena Easton said it was all right to have the same title.
So he doesn't need to worry about any publishing royalties coming from that. But yes, the Prince Estate, or the bank that is now administrating the Prince Estate, has announced that former artist manager Troy Carter is going to be their music industry advisor.
Mm-hmm.
The heirs, still presumed heirs, I think. I think that's still to be...
Yes, I don't think you've got as far as actual heirs.
Confirmed that those various siblings of Prince are definitely the heirs, but we feel that they probably are. And there was some disagreement amongst those siblings as to who should be the individual music business specialists advising the Prince Estate. They managed to agree on what bank should do all the money stuff, but they couldn't agree on who from the industry should be advising. The two guys that had been doing it since Prince's death a year ago, well, some of the siblings didn't like them, did they?
No.
So they were like, we don't want them, we want this guy. And the other siblings were like, well, we don't want that guy. So I assume, we've not actually had a statement from the heirs, but the estate have confirmed that Troy Carter is now advising them. So we assume that Troy was able to persuade all of the various siblings that he was the man to help the Prince Estate get the most from that catalogue. It's interesting because, of course, I say former artist manager, because these days, Troy Carter's main job is being a sort of the artist contacts guy at Spotify.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Because pretty much the same time Troy Carter's Prince deal was announced, Jay-Z pulled all his music off Spotify. And Jay-Z, of course, is the owner of Tidal, who the Prince Estate is currently suing.
So it all comes round in circles.
Yes.
So you may remember that there is a dispute between the Prince Estate and Tidal as to exactly what agreements were reached between Prince and Jay-Z and Tidal prior to Prince's death.
We have discussed this before.
Tidal were of the opinion that they had exclusive rights to everything, and the Prince Estate were basically of the opinion they had exclusive rights to nothing.
Yeah.
As a result of which, the Prince catalogue went back onto Spotify, where Troy Carter is the head of artist liaison. So Prince is streaming on Spotify, but legal wrangling with Jay-Z and Tidal continues. Meanwhile, most of Jay-Z's catalogue, it was very confusing because some were saying all of it and then some were saying some of it, and then no one was really commenting on this.
I think,
but there's a chunk
probably,
of Jay-Z's.
I think it depends from territory to territory, but in the UK, certainly his first three albums were still available, but otherwise gone. And then like US publications were saying only his collaborations with R. Kelly were still available.
So it possibly depends. It may be in some territories there are some complicated sort of side deals with labels and distributors.
Yeah,
that means
and with that Apple Music, things seem to kind of come and go.
So who knows? But Jay-Z has removed some of his content off some of the streaming services, with the exception, of course, of Tidal.
Yes, which luckily has managed to keep the rights to everything.
Well done, them.
It's a bit of a hard negotiation there.
A bit of a coup there on the
Tidal's
part.
Can I keep my music on here? Yes, you can. Good, thanks, me. That's probably how that negotiation went. You can act out other things if you want. I could act out the new Kendrick Lamar artwork.
Go on, then. I don't think that will work for our listeners.
Maybe not. Go and look at it. It's
awful.
Well,
so this is Kendrick Lamar's
new album. I'm warm to it.
Kendrick Lamar's new album will probably be out by the time listening to this podcast.
It will.
And so this week he tweeted, Instagrammed, Facebooked.
All of those.
The artwork for the new record, it looks a little bit like a GCSE graphic design project.
It really breaks all of the rules of design.
Lots of people have been commenting on this on the old social networks, and the designer of said artwork has responded and says that everyone's missing the point.
The point is it's supposed to be bold and abrasive.
By being a bit shit.
By being really bad. Well, if you design something badly on purpose, is it bad design?
Well, it's like there was a period, it's a while ago now, but the Courier typeface. It used to be in the old days when fonts were a bit of a nightmare that if you designed something and then when you printed it out, something went wrong with the fonts, your printer would default to Courier, an old-fashioned sort of typewriter type typeface. Mm. And so therefore no designers used Courier because it was sort of the mistake font. So you didn't use Courier in your design because it was what things looked like when things went wrong.
Yeah.
So using Courier was a no-no in the graphic design circles. So then, of course, some trendy graphic designers sort of reclaimed Courier, and then there was a couple of years where everything was in Courier. So, yeah, sometimes breaking the rules. Although if he really wanted to break the rules, he would have gone with Comic Sans, wouldn't he? So he hasn't completely rebelled against graphic design rules.
Yeah, there was a little while when it looked like Comic Sans might have a little bit of a
hipster comeback.
A hipster comeback, but it didn't really happen.
It was like the
cassette
revival.
I once attended a very interesting talk by the person who designed the Comic Sans font. That was fun.
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't think, having spent so long talking about the Beatles vinyl collector magazine, that we have time for a tangent on your on the Comic Sans talk.
It's unfortunate.
But people can find out more not about the history of Courier and Comic Sans, but they can find out more about all of these stories by doing what?
By going to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, where you'll find the show notes for this show, in which will be placed links to all of the stories discussed. And finally, this week, Kate Bush did not play Coachella in 2015.
Breaking news.
Bye.
So there has been lots of discussion this week. Coachella is coming up. It might even be happening as this podcast goes out. It may have happened. Are there still two weekends of Coachella?
Yes, the first weekend is this weekend. The following weekend is the second.
So even if you're listening to this podcast quite late,
you could still get to the second
You could weekend. Still get to the second weekend of
Coachella.
If you
leave now, you might just get there in time.
So there has been lots of chatter this week about whether or not it was ever on the cards for Kate Bush to play the Coachella Festival in 2015, and whether or not the reason it didn't happen was because the boss of Coachella said, we don't want Kate Bush for Coachella 2015. This all comes from a very long article in The New Yorker, because all articles in The New Yorker are very long, talking about the history of Coachella and how Coachella works, in which a possible hypothetical example was presented that resulted in all the chatter to the effect that in 2015, Coachella rejected Kate Bush playing the festival.
Yes. So this article obviously is very long, as you say, but it covers the history of the festival, lots of things. And largely it's focused on Paul Tollett, the founder of the festival, who still runs it to this day.
Yeah, even though it is now in part owned by the monolith that is AEG.
Yes. But he's still
in charge.
He's still in charge. He still retains a controlling stake in it. And he still personally negotiates every act on the bill, which takes 6 months of his year just to do that.
And so part of this article was discussing the conversations that happen between the booking agents over here and him over there when they're deciding what bands should play.
Yes. So they spoke to Mark Geiger, who is head of music at WME, and he gave this example of how a negotiation will go. I think this is truncated. I don't think it would happen this quickly. But he said, I'll say Kate Bush, and he'll go, no, and we'll talk it through. I'll say, she's never played here, and she just did 30 shows in the UK for the first time since the late 70s. You gotta do it, have to. No, no one is going to understand it. Following on from that, 7 million stories saying Kate Bush was rejected from Coachella because the audience wouldn't understand her.
From that, what we suspect was a hypothetical example that this WME boss was talking about, or music boss was talking about.
Also, it's possible that he did put her forward without, just on spec. Yeah, and hoped that if Tollett said yes, he could convince Kate Bush, as unlikely as that would be. So it's not impossible that they had this conversation, but it does seem that it was pretty hypothetical.
In the wake of all of that chatter over the internet to the effect that Kate Bush had wanted to play Coachella in 2015 and the Coachella boss had said, no, our audience won't get it, Kate Bush was then forced, well, her spokesperson was forced to put out a statement saying, even if this conversation did happen, which it might not have done, because this might have been a hypothetical example, but if it wasn't a hypothetical example and this conversation did happen, as you say, it was the agent floating the idea, Kate Bush was never involved in the conversation and had never expressed an interest in playing Coachella, or for that matter, any festival anywhere in the world.
It's worth having a quick recap of what shows we're talking about. So in 2014, she played her first live shows for 35 years. It was 22 shows, not 30. He got that wrong as well. And they were all at the Hammersmith Apollo. And they were it wasn't just a straight greatest hit set. It was a show with a narrative, story running through it. It used multimedia. There was puppetry. There was video.
It was very theatrical.
There was acting.
Is your point.
Dancing. It was not a festival show. And I think if that conversation happened, to be fair, Paul Tollett was right. That was not a show that was going to work at any festival.
Which you said in your report on this before the Kate Bush statement.
Which basically said the same thing.
So it wasn't that Coachella boss was saying the people that come to my festival are too thick to be able to appreciate Kate Bush. Even though they might be. He was basically saying that was a really theatrical show that clearly is not going to work on a festival stage in a big open area with a whole load of drunk people who've been watching bands since midday. So it's a stupid idea. We don't want to do it. And even if he had said that he wanted to do it, we now know that Kate Bush's response immediately would have been, that's a stupid idea. I don't want to do it.
Yes, a spokesperson for Kate Bush said, it was never Kate's intention to play any more shows than she did in London. The show was conceived for a very specific type of venue. No discussions were ever had about Kate playing any festival, including Coachella.
So Kate Bush did not play Coachella. She is not playing Coachella this year. And I get the impression she will never be playing Coachella.
Or anywhere else ever
Well,
again.
She's never not given much of an indication that she will return to the stage at any point. And as you also pointed out in your article, it was only when the live album of these shows came out last year that she even gave an interview about the whole thing.
Yeah, so it took her 2 years to release a live album.
And 2 years to even comment on
the
show.
Well, more than 2 years. Well, yeah, 2 years after the shows to comment. She didn't do anything beforehand. Going back and looking at those interviews that she did last year, it was filmed for a DVD release, which she decided not to put out. So, you're not even going to get. If you didn't go, you're not going to get to see him.
Also, I think all the people who went, I think all of whom were universally wowed by the show. But I think part of being wowed was the slight smug feeling that these shows were never going to happen again, and it was a real moment in time. And I was there, and I wasn't there.
But I wasn't there.
I'm talking about the people who were there. I was there and no one else will ever see this. And so I think it would slightly ruin that for those Kate Bush fans if suddenly there was a big global tour that included festival dates. But anyway, that was a sort of non-story that became very big. As you say, an incredibly long article.
Yeah,
and this one little tiny quote became such a big news story.
An article that is worth going to read in full. There's a lot of interesting little nuggets of information. The history of the festival is really interesting. How it started, how Golden Voice, the promoter that started it, came into being, how it became a successful. We're going from like promoting like hardcore punk shows to being successful enough to put on this massive festival in the desert. First of which it lost like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars because although there was putting on gigs successfully, had no idea how to run a festival.
No, and also the story about why they decided to do a festival in the first place and then subsequently working with AEG.
And it was working with AEG. It was AEG that was responsible for the festival going ahead because obviously they did it. They lost all this money on the first one and they were like, well, we'll not do that again. Then AEG came along and said, we want to buy Golden Voice. And by the way, we want you to carry on doing that festival. And they were like, we lost loads of money. And they went, it was your first year of a festival. That's what happens. And they hadn't considered that.
Also, for my favourite bit was he was talking about the year before they launched Coachella, he went to Glastonbury with the idea to sort of go and pitch it to artists, come to California, we're going to set up a fair. Because I suppose the sort of the European festival format isn't as big in the US even to this day and certainly wasn't back then. And so he was going to all these artists saying, hey, we're going to do a festival in California, you should come. And almost his pitch, bearing in mind this was quite a grim, wet, miserable Glastonbury, was to just bring photos of his sunny Californian desert where his event was going to be happening. It's like, imagine doing what you're doing now, but here in the sunshine, come to my festival.
It was a good font chat as well.
I love a good font chat.
Yeah, it was, as you will have discovered from the previous section on this podcast, quite like fonts. And there was a good section on font size
is
on the Coachella
poster. Politics of that.
The politics of font size.
I've had that conversation with agents
and
before.
And how you know, you can have a long negotiation over increasing a font size by 1 point. Because for some artists, like the font size on the poster can dictate what they earn on their shows, you know, from that point onwards. And also discussion of trying to decide how popular EDM DJs are, because it's not as simple as just going like, that band sold that many records, so they go here on the poster and their name is this size. I mean, there were examples of saying, like, you know, you might book an EDM artist and they're particularly popular 3 months or 6 months in advance of the festival. They could be a lot more popular or a lot less popular by the time you actually get to the event. So you've got to really
That's true of bands, surely, isn't it? Is he saying
it is, but he's saying it was harder to judge because they don't sell records in the same way. They don't play, like, festivals and tours in the same way.
There isn't a promo cycle.
So you kind of have to judge it on their social media stats.
Right, interesting.
And that makes it more difficult.
So you will include a link to this New Yorker article?
Sure I will.
In the podcast notes?
Yeah.
So just do the wrap-up bit, because I've got to go. I've got places to be.
All right, well, one place we've got to be is Canada. Not right now, but that's where we'll be next week, so the podcast will not be here next week. We'll be off again.
Canadian Music Week. If you're at Canadian Music Week on the Friday morning of the conference, we will be presenting a three-hour session. We will explain to you everything you need to know about digital dollars. So if you don't like reading and you don't want to read our big, long reports that the Music Managers Forum put out, I will explain it all to you, and we'll have various interviews and panels where we tell you everything you need to know about the streaming business, how it works, what happens to the money, and the challenges ahead. So if you're in Toronto at CMW, come and say hello. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, though.
Yes.
With the old podcast.
Yes. So, if you're not in Toronto and you want to hear our voices, I mean, if you're in Toronto, you can just come up and, like, I don't know, don't punch me in the arm. Why am I suggesting that?
I don't know. Just
punch Chris in the arm and I'll laugh, and then you'll hear noises come out of our mouths, which is, I'm sure, what you want.
I'm going to be on stage for 3 hours talking. That would be the best place to come
run
and hear
on
me
stage.
Talk.
No, run on stage and punch Chris in the arm. That's what you should do. Or if you're not in Toronto, you should just subscribe to the podcast and you'll get the next episode when we come back automatically. And that will be marvellous. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Great jingle.